ॐ भद्रं कर्णे पिश्रुन्व्यामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमाक्षभिर्यजत्राः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तुष्टुवागुंसस्तनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्रो वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु। ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः। Okay, I'm going to start chanting from Vivikta Deshe. Did they find that?
Which verse is it?
I don't know, my verses are different. Wait a minute, I'll tell you.
What number?
1 minute. Oh, it's in this little book that you have to include. It's on page 74. It's verse 4 and 5. So I'm going to chant 4, 5, 6, and 7. This is a section, okay? Repeat after me. Vivikta-deshe chasukasanastah. Vivikta-deshe chasukasanastah. Suchisamakriva-shira-sharirah. Suchisamakriva-shira-sharirah. Achashramastasakalendriyani Nirujabhaktyaswagurum pranamya Fritpundarikam virajam vishuddham. And I'm all by myself. I'll just stand alone then. Vichinchamadje vishuddham vishokam Achinchyam avyaktam anantarupam Shivam prashantam amritam brahmayonim Samadhi madhyanta vihinamekam Dibhum charanandam arupam adbhutam Umasahayam parameshwaram prabhum Trilochanam nilakantam prashantam Yatwa munir kachati bhutayonin samastasakshinam tamasat parastat. Okay. In this section, the Kaivalya Upanishad is actually teaching you how to meditate, and while teaching you how to meditate, is also giving you the vision. It's kind of interesting. It's not usually like that. Usually they'll give the vision and then they'll teach you how to meditate. But here they're giving you the vision as they're teaching you how to meditate. So if you remember some of this that we've already covered, but just to kind of say it in English, right? It starts out in the instruction in verse 7 on mine. Are you lost, Edward?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. It says, for a person who's sitting in a comfortable asana, sitting, you know, seated in a comfortable position, in a Vivikta Desha, in a place where there aren't any other people, but a place where you can be alone, and in a chair, or in if you do some yoga in an asana, that where you can actually be comfortable and totally relax your body, and the place should be suchihi. It should be clean. It should be pleasing. And your posture when you're sitting, your spine should be straight. Means that your head and your neck and your torso should be properly aligned, so that all of your muscles can relax. Otherwise, say if your head's moving forward, your head's like a bowling ball. It weighs about 10 pounds or so, and it really will cause a lot of muscle stress on your muscles. So you should be able to be in a position where the body is completely supported. Either the skeleton is supporting the body, or you're in a comfortable chair like this and the chair is supporting you. So that all of the muscles can completely relax. So he's explaining this just in terms of the posture. And then he also says, because this is very kind of traditional, he said the ashrama, it should be the final ashrama. Mm-hmm. In other words, you should be in the sannyasa ashrama. That's what this being said. Ati ashrama, the final ashrama, person who's abiding in the final ashrama. The ashramas are brahmacharya, when you're young and a student, then grihastha, a householder, then vanaprastha, when your marriage is, you've become old enough, the children have all left, and now you're living instead of as husband and wife, more as brother and sister, you know, and your life together is just devoted to the shastra and to gaining this knowledge. And then after that, if you're going through all of the stages in life, you know, there's a separation where the two of you, the man usually takes sannyasa and goes out, and the woman will live as a sannyasi in the home. So the idea is, you don't have to go through all of these ashramas to be in the final ashrama, in the sannyasa ashrama. But I think what they're saying here is that in terms of the Upanishad, the teaching of an Upanishad, which is meant to give you liberation, moksha, it's meant to give you moksha. If that teaching is going to be productive, if it's going to bear fruit, your mind has to, at this point in your life, recognize a certain level of what we call vairagya. It means that you have to have a certain level of recognition that whatever the pursuit is that you've been doing, or all of the pursuits that you have been doing, are doing, or will be doing in the future, that these pursuits for happiness are actually dukkha yonis. Dukkha yonis means they have sorrow embedded in them, because every accomplishment, every phala, every result of all of your actions, every result that you get is by nature time-bound. And so since it is time-bound, the happiness or the pleasure that you receive from the attainment or the accomplishment is also time-bound. And at the end of that moment of ananda, we call that dukkha, because nobody wants their ananda to come to an end. Right? That's a sorrowful thing, to think that when the happiness that you were experienced kind of fades away or drifts away. And so there has to be a time in a person's life, I mean, not, there doesn't have to be, but in terms of the Upanishad, when a person recognizes that, or asks the question, is there something more? Is there an ananda, or a wholeness, a well-being, a sense that all is well with me, that is not time-bound, that isn't attached to or associated with the acquiring of something, or the getting rid of something for that matter? I'd be so happy if I didn't have to do this. We have that too. I'd be so happy if I could only have this, or I'd be so happy if, you know, if my relationship was a little stronger. I'd be so happy if, you know, my child was doing better in school. I mean, it's endless. It's endless, all of the conditions that we tend to put forward that will make us happy, or the things that we need to get rid of that will make us. But all those things, in any case, all of those things are time-bound. So the question can arise, is there any way that I could just be free, where I can say, all is well with me, period, and not in a pretend way, where the actual affect, my actual state of being is free, in the sense that all is well with me, in spite of the world means whether the world is giving me what I need to be happy or it's not giving me what I need to be happy, I'm fine. It's kind of like the example they use for vairagya is if a child has a helium balloon, of course you know what happens with helium balloons. You probably remember when you were a child you have a helium balloon. It will eventually either deflate, or worse than that even, is when it's in its prime, it slips through your fingers. Right? When it's nice and fresh and big, it slips through your fingers and goes up into the sky. So for a child, that's traumatic. For an adult, say you get your child a helium balloon and you get one for you. If it slips through your fingers, I don't think that you would be grieving. Right? The helium balloon is no longer under your control, but you can enjoy its flight. And you could also enjoy it when you had it. And in fact, you were even fine before you had it. So before, during, and after the possession of the helium balloon, you were absolutely fine. That is vairagya. That is what we mean by dispassion. For jnani, for jivan mukta, that vairagya is complete. I am fine before, during, and after the rise and fall of all of the events that are going on in my entire life. It is fine. The only way that can be is if I've recognized a source of ananda, of wholeness, which is independent of these objects. I need to have realized that completely and thoroughly, and then I will be free. And so here, this final ashrama, either this final stage of life, either for a young person or for an old person, the sannyasa ashrama, the ashrama of renunciation, is based upon this vairagya. And for a mumukshu, one who's desirous of liberation, for that person, it's the question, is there such a thing? The seeking. I'm seeking that. And for the jnani, the one who has knowledge, it's the fulfillment of that seeking. Yes, there is such a thing, and that thing is my being, that thing is Brahman, is my very being. And so that's the freedom. So for such a person, whether a mumukshu, one seeking liberation, or for a jnani, meditation is meaningful. You know? So think about why I say this. Why do they say this final ashram? Think about what you do in meditation. By yourself, comfortable position, shut down all your sense organs. Okay? No more world is gone. Okay? Shut down your sense organs. Do japa or breathe or pranayama or something in order to quiet your mind. All the thoughts become, you're withdrawn from all of the thoughts. Look at what's happening. You're actually withdrawing. You're withdrawing from sensory experience. At least initially, you're withdrawing from sensory experience. You're even resolving the mind, making the mind be quiet and turning it inward. Why would you do such a thing? Why would you even be interested in doing such a thing if there wasn't some mumukshutvam, some desire for liberation, some questioning, some asking, is there anything about me that is whole and complete, period? Does such a thing exist? We know for a seeker, for somebody who's analyzed their experience, it's very clear that that does not exist in the world. Because in the perceptual world, even in the mental, emotional world, everything that you experience is totally bound by change. That's its swarupa, that's its swabhava, its nature. There's not a thing you can do about it. You know, that's it would be trying to freeze frame something that by its very nature is changing. Right? And so if that's the nature of the, if that's the condition of the universe that you experience, to ask it to stop and give you something lasting is an impossibility, and sooner or later that dawns on you. It's kind of like, oh my God, why didn't I see that before? Because there's no way it can't be that way. Right? And so then the question is, if you're a seeker for something that is a substantial wholeness that is not bound by time, we have to look elsewhere. And where is the elsewhere? The elsewhere can't be within time and space, because anything within time and space is subject to, anything within duality itself is subject to this constant motion. And so the elsewhere is only going to be towards the, is only going to be the subject, not the object. So what do we do when we meditate? We're resolving all of our experience into what is left there after all of the experience that can be objectified is resolved. What is left there, in fact, is only me. Okay. And so this type of a pursuit requires to have we don't do things that we're not interested in. And so to have a pursuit like this, one has to be interested. To be interested, one has had to assimilate their experience. That's why they said this has got to be this final ashrama, the sannyasa ashrama. And then being such a person, then what do you do? Sakala indriyani, all of the indriyas, all of the organs of action, all of the sense organs, nirujya, having withdrawn. Then bhakya swagurum pranamya, then having done namaskar pranams to one's teacher, one's guru, with devotion, bhakti, bhakya gurum pranamya. Why do they say that? Because without a teacher, there's really nothing to meditate on. It's an interesting problem. In fact, let's put it like this. I remember when I was about, I guess I was 18, and I was in LA, and I went with a group of friends to hear this teacher give a talk, a sannyasi to give a talk. And he gave the talk, and I don't remember anything that he said. He was talking something about meditation. And then we were all invited to go and get a mantra and meditate. I'd never meditated before in my life. I didn't know anything about India. I didn't know about Sanskrit. I didn't know about mantras. I'd never heard such anything about it. Nothing. But anyway, we all went to get this mantra. And I remember going, being kind of taken into the guru's room. He was sitting in there. He was in this little house out in the country outside of LA. So they took us, they took me into the, by myself. I had to go into this room. He was sitting there cross-legged, and there was kind of this desk in front of him, and I had to go sit in front of him. And he just looked at me quietly, and then he said this mantra. This mantra was Brahma. So he said, just looked at me, and he said, Brahma. Brahma. I was so, felt so awkward. Did anyone need to repeat it? So I said, Brahma. Brahma meant nothing. I had a clue what Brahma was. It's a foreign language. I had no idea. So he said, you just go and repeat this. Go and repeat this. And he told me a few things about it. So when I got home, I went and I sat in my bathroom, because that was the only quiet place there was. Shut the door, because they were all, you know, we're all college kids, real. So that was my quiet place. So I shut myself in there, and I said, sat there quietly, going, Brahma. 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 And I was feeling awkward. Brahma. Brahma in the bathroom. Brahma. Brahma. And then everything was really quiet. I said it for a long time. Everything was really got quiet. You know, my body was relatively relaxed. I was comfortable. My mind was quiet because I said this Brahma, Brahma. And now I was just sitting there, waiting. Just waiting. And then I didn't know what to do. It was quiet. My mind was quiet. So I was just sitting there. And then I remember having this kind of thought. It was kind of like, I'm bored. And then there was this kind of a, so what? There's no teaching. What was I supposed to do with that silence? I had no clue what it was. The sense organs were quiet. The mind was quiet. You know, there was just actually pure being. Quiet being. It was kind of a dull quiet being. You know, it wasn't any big almond or anything. It was kind of this dull, quiet being. And I was bored, and I had no idea where it was. It meant nothing to me. There's no teaching. There was no teaching, but I didn't even know there was supposed to be teaching. It's ignorance upon ignorance upon ignorance upon ignorance. I had no idea. You know, so here, in this tradition, the Upanishads are a tradition. It's part of the Vedic tradition. So a student, the sishya, the student, goes to their teacher. Right? Their teacher is the guru. The teacher is there to give them knowledge, to instruct them, to pass this knowledge on, to make them know, to make them see, to make them recognize. That's the job of the teacher. So the sishya goes to the teacher. If the sishya accepts the guru, the teacher as their teacher, and the teacher accepts the sishya, then what happens is that there's a teaching that takes place. And this teaching takes the student step by step by step to recognizing the nature of that silence, which has underlined everything. The very nature of yourself. you know, which is underlying everything. The student needs to see that, and they see that, recognize it through a teaching methodology that their teacher takes them through, right? And so there's a certain, because what the guru, what the teacher is teaching you is very subtle. You know, it's not like, say teaching, this is a cup. This is a cup. You know, you don't need a lot of shraddha for that. You can be, shraddha means a kind of a desire and a willingness and an openness to really understand. You can be bored to death, and I can say, hey, just pay attention for it. This is a cup. Everybody look at the cup. Then you'll all look at the cup. Okay, we know that's a cup. This isn't quite like that. This teaching requires your mind to be present for a period of time. You know, as the teaching goes through, pointing step by step by step to make you objectify, to objectify all of the things in your experience that can be objectified, and then turn your experience toward the subject, the conscious being that you are, that in fact can't be objectified, which is self-evident but can't be objectified as an object. It's a teaching methodology to take you to that recognition. To have the wherewithal to kind of follow that process, you need the certain vairagya, you need to have kind of understood the problem, and you need to have what we call shraddha, a kind of a faith-pending understanding that both the teacher and the teaching methodology will take you there. You don't know. Until you see it, you don't know. And so there has to be some willingness to see. That's what we call shraddha. And so that doing prostrations to the teacher with that bhakti, all that means is that I am open to, and I want to learn this from this Upanishad, which is taught by this teacher. That's what it is. And that means that then your mind is available. So really not any more than that. It means your mind is available. But think of the opposite. If the mind isn't available, then first of all, you probably wouldn't be there, sitting there. And if you were sitting there, it would be kind of torturous. Because you wouldn't be that interested, and you'd be stuck, you know. So that's how he introduces. Then he goes on to say, now, that being so, you're seated in this meditative posture. Then he says, this Vrit Pundarikam, Vrit means the heart, the lotus heart. The lotus heart means your mind, about your mind. Your mind, which is like a lotus, which is pleasing like a lotus, means it's virajam. It's free of rajas. It's free of impurities. It's something which has become free of raga dvesha, free of likes and dislikes. So, as Swamiji says, here would be something like this. Visualizing or imagining your mind as being pleasing. Imagine yourself with a pleasing mind, Prit Pundarikam, a mind that is pleasing like a lotus. Imagine your mind, bring your mind now into the condition of being objective, of being free of your likes and dislikes, of being somebody who in fact is aware of, who can objectify all of your likes and dislikes, but can for now let them go, be free of them. And imagine yourself being free of all of these likes and dislikes, all of these conditions that we put upon the world and put upon myself. I need the world to be like this, and I need you to be like that, and this horrible person to go away. All these likes and dislikes. I, you know, let myself be free of those for the time being. Imagine my mind as free of them. And being free of them, my mind becomes what we call pure. Just think of it, really. It's a beautiful thing. Like, for instance, if you're walking in nature, or you're listening to some beautiful music, you know, or you're playing with your pet. So many different things. You're playing with your child or the smile. How about with your nephew instead of your child? The child's too big of a burden. Too many problems. But you get your nephew or your little niece. So you get that wonderful little smile and all of the freedom that's in that. So imagine, you know, those times when, in fact, the world is not imposing anything on me. Right? At that time, I'm free of my likes and dislikes. I'm just enjoying the world as it is. Especially we can think walks in nature, you know, listening to beautiful music, enjoying some friends. At that time, everything is fine with me. So bring that type of a buddhi. Bring that type of a mind. Imagine that type of a mind. Let go of all of the conditions. Okay? Just think of yourself sitting in meditation. Imagine, let me have just a peaceful, beautiful mind. Let me let go of all my likes and dislikes. And let me just abide in that state of what we call purity. It's free of mola, it's free of raga dvesha. So imagining that vishadam, vishokam, such a mind, but I'm imagining that, such a mind is what we call something that is pure, something, and being pure, the one that's, you know, relieved of the raga dvesha, it's vishokam, it's free of sorrow, right? So sitting in meditation, I evoke this type of a mind, you know? I evoke this type of a mind. Swamiji actually, and so do I for that matter, do so many different types of meditative exercises that evoke this type of a mind, you know, where you're evoking the inner friend and being with your mind in such a way as to calm all of the different parts that are upset. So you actually create, when you sit in meditation, one of the first things you do, besides creating a body that is relaxed and pleasing, a relaxed body is a pleasing, comfortable body, you also create, you know, and through imagination, really, you know, a quiet and peaceful mind by releasing all of the likes and dislikes for yourself. So you imagine that mind, and you abide in a mind that is free of sorrow. And then, having done that, I'm picking this a little bit out of order now. The next thing we can do is jhatva. Jhatva means now having done that, now we can contemplate on what we call Ishwar Saguna Brahman. Saguna Brahman means now we bring to mind the Parameshwaram. Parameshwaram means the Lord, the Ishwar. Uma Sahayam Parameshwara. The Lord, we're thinking by the Lord, Parameshwara, Ishwara. Uma Sahayam. Uma Sahayam means the Lord together with Maya, the Maya Upadhi. Ishwara, which has Uma. Uma is here, the Maya Upadhi. Uma has a lot of different meanings. It can also mean jnanam, just knowledge. But here, Uma Sahayam means the whole Ishwara. So keeping in mind, imagining now the Saguna Brahman. Saguna Brahman is the Parameshwaram, means having objectified my body, mind, sense organs, releasing myself from raga dvesha, I now place that body, mind, sense organs into the Parameshwara, into Ishwara's order. I realize that this body, mind, sense organs is part of an infinite order. And that infinite order, and it's an infinite order on every level. There's an infinite order on this physical, it's with science, on the infinite, the order of science on the physical, on this physical realm. The infinite order of psychology on the emotional realm. The infinite order of biology and physiology on the realm of the body. On every realm imaginable, there is an infinite order which contains me. Right? This body, mind, sense organs, every part of me is contained within an infinite network of laws. The Swamiji will call the infinite order. That infinite order is not separate from you. And so in objectifying this physical body, I then place this physical body in this infinite order, which we call Parameshwara, which we call Ishwara. The conscious being with the infinite order is Parameshwara, and the Umasamat Sahayam is what is responsible for the names and forms and the infinite manifestation of duality that we experience. So I'm kind of racing over this. I'm not doing a real unfoldment of it right now. We'll do it later. But I just have to get rid of some, work on some of these words for a minute. Having meditated on Umasahayam Parameshwaram, the Lord, which is this infinite manifestation of creation, which is Prabhum, which is all-powerful, the conscious being that is responsible for the manifestation of the creation, the sustenance of the creation, the resolution of the creation, the Prabhum, which is this Lord, which is Trilochanam, which has three eyes. The three eyes of the Lord are the sun, the moon, the stars, and the Agni. The moon, the sun and the stars, right, the suns, the moons, and the Agni, the fire. All of the things that are Prakashikas, all of the things that illumine, those are considered the Trilochanam, the eyes of the Lord. Nilakantam, the one who has a blue neck, the sky, right? The one for whom the water is the bladder, the one for whom the earth is the feet. They do an upasana, you know, it's a meditation visualizing this whole infinite creation as Parameshwara, the Purusha and the Prakriti. The Purusha is the conscious being, is consciousness itself. The Prakriti is Uma, the Maya is Uma. So if we take the conscious being, in fact, which is Satchitananda, the consciousness of the self, this conscious being, plus the Maya, the total Maya, is what we call Parameshwara, the Lord, with Uma, with the Maya Upadhi. And then we visualize, in meditation, we visualize that whole Ishwara. How do we visualize it? Well, look at all of the luminaries, those are the eyes of Bhagawan, of Parameshwara. Look at the blue, the blue sky, that's the blue neck. Right? Sometimes the earth, sometimes space is looked at as the feet, because the space is all pervasive. Sometimes the earth is looked at as the feet. The rains are looked at as the bladder. Right? And so, in a sense, it's looking at the entire creation as a cosmic being. That's what we call Saguna Brahman. Brahman is consciousness. Right? Saguna Brahman is consciousness plus Namarupa, plus the infinite names and forms. So consciousness plus the infinite names and forms. Now we try to imagine that, do an upasana, where you imagine in your mind this whole infinite creation as a conscious being. So how to do that? Well, the sky is his neck, the sun and the moon are his eyes, the feet are, the earth is his feet, the rains are his bladder. So it'll go on in the Brihadaranyaka, there's upasanas like this where you evoke this imagination, and now as evoking the whole Saguna Brahman, this imagination of the Lord, now place yourself in that, because your body, mind, sense organs are not away from this manifestation of the creation. So imagine Saguna Brahman, imagine this creation as a conscious being of which your body, mind, sense organs are a part. Okay? So he starts out here with the imagination, with the meditation on Ishwara's form. And then from there, that's called the Jayam, the thing which is to be meditated upon. And from there, in this teaching, from there he goes into what is Jnayam, what is to be known, right? You yourself, as a jiva, it's body, mind, sense organs, you're part of the Saguna Brahman. So if you're imagining the Lord as this whole universe as a conscious being, then this body, mind, sense organs is included in that imagination. But now we want to look at what is the nature of the conscious being. What is the nature of the conscious being from whom this entire creation comes, is sustained, and resolves? What is the nature of the conscious being that is the self of the Lord? What is the nature of the conscious being which is the self of the Lord? And so then he says like this, that conscious being is achintyam. It's something that can't be objectified by your mind. Just think of this, consciousness. You only have the only way you have access to consciousness for yourself, even to imagine it, right, is to be it. And if we say the word consciousness, consciousness isn't something you can objectify. Even right now I'm talking, you know, you can objectify the sun and the moon and the blue sky, and you can objectify an infinite order, and you can imagine the infinite, you can have an imagination of the infinite creation. It's your own imagination, but still you can imagine it. Now try to have an imagination of consciousness, a thought of consciousness. You can't have a thought of consciousness because the consciousness is a chintya. It doesn't have a thought form. It's not a form, right? Consciousness illumines your mind. You can have all kinds of thoughts in your mind, but the consciousness which the mind is enjoys can't be held in a form. And you also, it's a chintyam, it's a vyaktam, it's also not something you can see with your eyes. But consciousness is. Consciousness is. It's not away from you at all. You say, I am a conscious being. It's just if I were to ask you, what's that consciousness look like? You would know, I am a conscious being, but I'd say, yeah, okay, well, what does it look like? And you say, it's not an object that I can look at. Well, can you imagine it? Can you think about it? Can you imagine consciousness? Well, no, not really, because what would the imagination be of? What would the imagination of consciousness look like? So it's not something that I can objectify like that. You can't imagine it. You can't think of it in terms of a thought. And you also can't see it in terms of an object in the world. And yet, you say, I am consciousness. You know very well what it is. And everybody, every one of us can say it, yes, I am a conscious being. But it's not something that I can imagine or look at. But also he says, and this consciousness is anantarupam, means it is of limitless form in this sense. It's not one form. If it's one form, you can imagine it. If you say it is of endless form, you can't imagine it because there's nothing which it is not. If you say consciousness, if it's one form, then it's an object of the creation. If it's limitless forms, what that means is that there is no form in the creation that is not that. Right? And yet, every form in the creation limits every other form. So if consciousness is anantarupam, that means that there's no form in the creation at all that's separate from it or away from it or is not it. And in fact, if you look at just your experience in this room, there isn't any experience that you have ever at any time, including any experience in this room, that is separate from consciousness. In fact, everything that you know in this room, if you say all of these things exist, like I can tell you in this room, okay, this table is, it exists. I can tell you, yes, it exists. How do you know it exists? Because I'm aware of it. That's how I know it exists. If I'm not aware of it, I don't know it exists. Right? So if this is, how do I know this is? Because I'm aware of it. How do I know this is? Because I'm aware of it. What if I'm not aware of it? Can I tell you that I know it exists? No, I know it exists because I'm aware of it. The rug, I know it exists. I'm aware of it. 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 There is absolutely nothing. And awareness I'm using as a synonym to consciousness. There is nothing, no form. The infinite form, there's no form that is not, that its being is not known because I'm aware of it, because of consciousness. And so all forms, in fact, to the degree that they enjoy isness, enjoy consciousness. For you to say it is to know it. So in fact, isness and awareness go together. So now, if you think about it, all of the names and forms, you can take the experience of this room and extend it to the infinite edges of the universe. And the same thing will apply, that there is nothing that is away from awareness. Isness and awareness go together. And so that means that the whole consciousness, in fact, is ananta rupam. For example, if I look at the ocean, which has countless waves, I can say that the water of the ocean, okay, the water is ananta rupam. Ananta means without end, forms without end, endless forms. And looking at the ocean, all that exists is the ocean. Looking at the ocean, I can say that the water is ananta rupam because there is no form that is not water. So in the same way, I can say consciousness is ananta rupam because there is no form that in fact is not consciousness. That's what it means. I need to do a lot more unfoldment on that, but I kind of done it simply for you. But when you say ananta rupam, it means that this whole maya, the umasahayam, the whole maya upadi, is nothing but consciousness. Just like all of these infinite, the countless waves in the ocean, the countless waves are ananta rupam. Right? They're countless waves. But that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying the water is ananta rupam. Because the countless waves are nothing but water. Right? So I'm saying this whole, what it says when you say ananta rupam, this whole creation is nothing but consciousness. Who's consciousness? Consciousness, the consciousness that you know, is not something that can be objectified as an object. You can't look at it. Right? Doesn't exist as an object within time and space. It doesn't exist as an object within the mental field of your imagination, but it is the conscious being because of which this mental field is known, right? Even for you to say the mental field, the emotional field, the mental field, the subtle realm of your mind is because you're aware of it, because it's known. If it's not known, you can't even say that it is. So in fact, the isness and the knownness of the mental field, the mental field is the consciousness, which is now pervading and pervasive to the mental field. That consciousness is ananta rupam because there's no part of the mental field, the mind, that's away from or known or separate from consciousness. And there's nothing in this physical realm either that is away from the consciousness, which is what? Which is me. It's not anybody else. There is no other consciousness. Right? In my experience, there is no other consciousness. Everything is, this whole creation that's objectifiable, the whole mental realm that's objectifiable, who is the subject of that? It's me, the conscious being. Okay, just to bring you back, remember we're learning how to meditate? What do I do when I meditate? Vivek-Tadesha, you get into a quiet place, make your body very comfortable, remove the raga dveshas, the likes and dislikes from your mind so that your mind has some relative peace, right? Quieten the mind, withdraw the sense organs, quieten the mind, and then what? Turn the mind toward the one that's illumining it. Right? Who is the one illumining it? Me. Who am I? The conscious being. Who is the conscious being? The conscious being is a chintan. It's something that can't be objectified by the mind. It's a vyaktam. It's something that can't be objectified through the sense organs. Who am I? It's ananta rupam. It's something that is not away from any perception, any object at all. Right? So just it's talking about yourself. It's shivam. Shivam means anandam. Means that which is most auspicious. That which is by nature the peace, the well-being that I seek. What is shivam? Is it that wholeness, that well-being that I seek? Right? In the world that I'm seeking, I'm trying to fulfill my desires, all my likes and dislikes, and trying to become what? Shivam. That which is the ananda, the well-being, the wholeness that I seek. That is the very nature of ananda. It is prashantam. Your being consciousness, is consciousness agitated? It can't be agitated because it's not objectifiable. It doesn't exist within duality. Right? It's not dual. So consciousness is absolutely prashantam. It's absolute peace. It's amritam. It's free from death because it's not an object in the creation to be subject to time. So it's amritam. And it's brahma yoni. Brahma yoni means it is that yoni, that cause, which is Brahman. Two ways to take this. Yoni means the cause. That literally means womb. It is the womb of all of this. You can say it is the womb of Brahmaji. It is the womb of Ishwara, the one that manifests as the creation, sustenance, and resolution. It is the very cause of that, the very womb of that, the very truth of that. Or it is that womb, that cause, which is itself Brahman, which is itself infinite. That womb which is itself infinite. So this conscious being is the womb, the self, the very cause, the very material cause, is the very truth of the entire creation. And then he says also, it is that conscious being which you are is Adi, Samadhi, Madhya, Antam, Vihinam. In itself, the being that you are is free, is without beginning. It's without middle, it's without end. It's free from beginning, middle, and end. Because free from time, right? That which can't be objectified doesn't have any time. So what that means is that the consciousness, this me, your sense of me, it isn't time bound. It didn't come into being, and it's not just, you know, abiding now, having been born, and will come to an end later. Like everything in the creation has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Not consciousness. The being that you are is free from time. And so this past, present, and future is not so for you, for your being. That means if, in terms of the creation, if I go back a billion years, the conscious being that is illumining it, the me that is illumining that, is the me that is here right now. Because there's no aging, right? There's no change for consciousness. So free from beginning, middle, and end. It is ekam. Ekam means one, non-dual. Consciousness, once you're not an object within duality, right? Once you're not an object within duality, for you there can be no parts. No duality, no parts. So you are one. Vibhum, all pervasive. Chidananda rupam. Your nature is consciousness. Ananda is limitless. Consciousness, which is limitless, means your being is unencumbered. Your being is not, there's no hindrance to your being. And so the self that you are has no hindrance, no obstruction. So we call the self that you are, from its own standpoint, is pure ananda, because it's unencumbered in any way, so it's absolutely free. So it's chidananda rupam. And it is adbhutam. Adbhutam, why? Adbhutam means it's wondrous. It's wondrous because it's you. And you hadn't taken yourself to be that. You've taken your being, the conscious being that you are, to be one with this body, mind, sense organs, and therefore subject to birth and death and old age and disease. And you're being this, subject to sukha and dukkha, to pleasure and pain and agitation and joy and the whole gamut of finite experiences that we enjoyed. You've taken yourself to be one with that. Kind of like a red hot iron ball where you take the iron to have the qualities of red and hot, and red and hot to have the qualities of round and heavy. It's all right to have all of these experiences, but when you take yourself to be one with them, you become subject to change and totally out of control. 1 minute you're this, 1 minute you're that. 1 minute you're happy, 1 minute you're sad. 1 minute you're agitated, 1 minute you're bored. 1 minute you're depressed, 1 minute you're joyous. There's no way to control your being if, in fact, all you are is a set of changing experiences. Which, in fact, you're not. You're the self that is constant amidst those changing experiences, but you haven't differentiated yourself. And so that self has, the self, the differentiated self, has to be recognized for what it is. And that self is a great wonder, because you had always taken yourself to be time-bound, and now you recognize the freedom of the natural freedom of your being, and the freedom of that being in relationship to the whole creation, to the point where you can say, I am the whole. The one Jivanmukta, the Jnani, can say, I am the whole. It's just like the wave that thought it was the water. The wave form says, I am the water. Now all of a sudden recognizes that the water that I am is the self of the whole. It's a very interesting thing. The wave form thought, I, the wave form, am the water. And now it comes to recognize that I am the water. That's true. I am the water. But the water that I am is the self of the ocean. Right? So it's a very subtle, because the wave is right. When the wave form says, I am the water, that's true. It is the water, right? In fact, there's nothing there but water. So its sense of self is absolutely correct. When that wave says, I am the water, it's referring to itself, which is only water. But what it doesn't know is that the water which it is free of the wave. When the wave form goes, nothing happens to the water at all. And in fact, the water is the self of the entire ocean. And so what the Jivanmukta, the one who's liberated, recognizes, the one who has self-knowledge, recognizes is that, oh, I, this body, mind, sense organs, I have taken to be me. In other words, so taking this body, mind, sense organs to be me, then what that means, of course, is that when this body dies, I die. When this mind has a given emotion, that's me. I am now happy, I am now sad, etc. But now what I recognize is, oh, this me, that is me in fact, right, is the self not only of this body, mind, sense, organs, but the self of the whole creation, yourself, 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 right? So all of these forms have me for their truth, but I am free of all of these forms. That's the satyam mitya. The mitya means all of these forms depend, say in the ocean, all the waves totally depend for their being on the water. The water is their truth. Their mitya means they totally depend on the water. Water is their truth. But the water is satyam, means it is what is really there. It is what is the absolute reality. That water doesn't depend on the wave at all. Right? The water is totally free of the waves. What if these poor waves, just imagine in the ocean, you have one of these extremely calm days. All the waves are wiped out. They're all gone. But is there a death experience? No death experience. Because nothing has happened. Nothing has happened to satyam, to what is really there. The water remains. It's the same. When you have a dream, this is the perfect example, really. When you have a dream, you go to sleep at night, and then you project this universe, which you participate in, and say it's really a vivid dream, and you're just totally engaged in it. And then something happens, the alarm goes off, or whatever. Dream's gone. all of the people are gone, the dream universe is gone, whoever the character you were identified with, gone, just like that, totally gone, whole universe gone, no death experience, nothing, not even the slightest death experience, because achintyam, objectum, nature of the conscious being that you are, right, is the sentient, it's the truth of it. Nothing happens to it at all. That's the reality, and this is the reality that needs to be recognized now. You know, and so here the teacher is teaching all of this within this process of, within this meditative process. And he says, you know, having recognized this is what we call the svarupa, that's the true nature. Having you imagine the whole Parameshwara, understand the whole name and form of this creation, and then recognize its truth, and in fact that is the conscious being which you are. Then the Muni, he says, having recognized this, the Muni means the meditator, the one who's meditating, Gajati Bhuta Yoni. He goes to that which is, he becomes, he goes to that which is the cause of all beings. Right? The conscious being, the conscious existence, which is the cause, the truth of all beings. That's where the meditator, the one who is resolving into the consciousness, resolves into what? That which is the water. That which is the very being, the conscious being, which is the truth of Bhuta Yoni, the truth of all beings. Which is Samasta Sakshinam, which is the witness of everything. In other words, the conscious being, from your standpoint, everybody who has a mind and sense organs, those are all known. Like in this room, say there's 10 of us in this room or so, for us, each one of our minds right now is known. Our sense organs are known, our perceptions are known. How are they known? By the consciousness which from the standpoint from each one of our minds is called the witness. The conscious being, right? The conscious being which illumines each mind, right? Is from the standpoint of that mind, the witness. Your mind is known, your mind is known, your mind is known, your mind is known, your mind is known. All minds are known. All perceptions are known. So consciousness, from the standpoint of all of these perceptions, is called the sakshi, the witness. So the consciousness is the one sakshi, the one witness of all. So what does that mean? The consciousness that I am is the consciousness that you are. There's not two of us. There's many minds, many perceptions, one consciousness. One consciousness which lights up all of those perceptions. So he says, the meditator is the one who becomes the samasta sakshinam, the witness of all that is, and the one who is tamasah parastat. Tamasah parastat, the one who is beyond ignorance, beyond darkness. The one who lights up darkness and light. The one who lights up knowledge and ignorance. Just like, for instance, if now it's light because of the light that's on, I'm aware of the light and everything in this room. If I turn all these lights off, it's totally dark, then I'm aware of the darkness. Consciousness is the one that illumines the light and illumines the darkness. I can say, I light up all, or we can use darkness in terms of ignorance. I light up all that I know. I know this, and I know this, and I know this. And I light up what I don't know. Oh, I'm ignorant of Chinese. I've never been to Scotland. I can tell you all kinds of things that I don't know, so I illumine what I know, I illumine what I don't know. Consciousness, awareness, is not bound by knowledge or ignorance, it illumines knowledge and ignorance. It's not bound by light or darkness, it illumines light and darkness. It's not bound by the opposites, sukha and dukkha, happy, pleasure and pain, it illumines pleasure and pain. That's why I can say, I'm in pain, or I'm happy, or one day I was happy, but the next day I was, you know, unhappy. Consciousness is the one that is always there, pervasive to and non-participatory in all of my experience. So that consciousness, the Muni, becomes. The Muni becomes what the becomes and goes to in the sense of recognizing who I am. This becoming or reaching or going to is only a becoming or reaching in terms of knowledge. Because the Muni, the one who is meditating, the one who is involved in this process, that Muni, he can say, goes to the body, means the Ahankara, the I notion, lands here on the body. I am the body for an ignorant person. Now for the Muni, the Ahankara, the I notion, lands on the self. It goes and it resolves in the self. And so that's what we mean by the going. Okay? Good stop here. Purnamadah Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vasishyate Om Shanti Shanti Shantihi Harihi Om Shri Gurupyo Namaha Harihi Om.